Regarding this practice, there's a saying from the Diamond Sutra, which I have quoted many times. And last week, this particular line from the Diamond Sutra was described in my Taisho as being the line that the sixth patriarch Wei Nung heard when he was only perhaps 13 years old, recited by a passing monk, and he had an awakening from this one line. And I'll repeat it as a launching pad for what we're going to talk about a little further tonight. But the line goes like this: allow mind, having no fixed abode, to flow forth. Allow mind, having no fixed abode, to flow forth. Now, it sounds a little puzzling. It's not the ordinary parlance that humans speak in, but it is exceedingly simple. In teaching Zen, one must be this simple in order to convey anything of value. However, the danger is that making it very simple, the mind will then latch on and make a superficial understanding of it, and that'll stop you from the process of merging with this truth. Because the human mind has a tendency to make abodes, to make fixed abodes. We're trained to do that, and it is a survival mechanism. And because we are all here, we're particularly good at doing that, and so were all of our ancestors from which we evolved. They were very good, eventually, when we reached the human level, at making fixed abodes. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about this, how one might convey this process of letting go of a fixed abode and allowing mind to flow forth. I'm going to start with a koan from the Book of Equanimity, and then I'm going to go on, and I'm in the spirit of this first Tuesday night of the month, I'm going to actually, and I haven't done this before, I'm going to read a few question and answers between students and myself in email about very specific questions kind of leading in this direction, this fixed abode versus simplicity, allowing mind to flow forth. We'll see how that works out. So let me start with this koan from the Book of Equanimity. In Japanese, this is known as the Shoyuroku, and it is a book of 100 koan that are viewed as the foundational koan for the Soto Zen sect, just like we would consider the Mumonkan as the foundational 48 koan of the Rinzai sect. So this is the Book of Equanimity, and this is the third koan in the Book of Equanimity, and I'm only going to read the case, and it's very short and very simple. So the case goes like this, and incidentally, every case starts, the case starts with a single word, attention, with an exclamation mark. Sets the tone for it. So this is the main case of case number 3, the title of which is An Invitation for the Patriarch. So the main case goes, attention! The ruler of a country in eastern India invited the 27th ancestor, Hunyatara, for a mid-morning meal. The ruler asked him, why don't you read the sutras? The ancestor replied, this poor follower of the way, when breathing in, does not dwell in the realm of skandhas, and when breathing out is not caught up in the many externals. Always do I thus turn 100,000, million, billion rolls of sutras. That's the koan. So apparently this ruler, this great person in Eastern India, heard of this 27th ancestor of the Buddha, Hunyatara. He's in the lineage. This was a great master of the time, Buddhist master. And it apparently was known about Hunyatara that he didn't read the sutras. So the ruler said, "Why don't you read them?" And I'll read his answer one more time. "This poor follower of the way, when breathing in, does not dwell in the realm of skandhas, and when breathing out, is not caught up in the many externals. Always do I thus turn 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, sutras, including the Diamond Sutra, are pointing at the same thing, which I think is so well distilled in that one line that I read initially, recited initially, allow mind having no fixed abode to flow forth. So this ancestor said, when breathing in, I don't dwell in the realm of the skandhas. Just a refresher memory if you aren't completely clear on this word skanda. They're considered to be five skandhas, which are the the technical meaning of them from the Sanskrit word is heaps. They're like heaps. So it'd be like if you had a, there's a koan about the cart. So the cart, let's say the cart had five pieces. You pulled off the wheels, you pulled off the axle, you pulled off the steering wheel, pulled off the tires, and you pulled out the engine. What would it be then, this pile? Okay. So when these skandhas are all assembled, they create what you might call yourself, your small self, the self that identifies with characteristics and stands apart. So this is mind having a fixed abode. So one of the ways the mind evolves this fixed abode and creates this entity that you call you yourself is by starting with form, the first skandha's form. So it's your what's happening. It's the level of actuality. And then perception. There's a knowing that you're perceiving it. Then recognizing, meaning fitting it into a schemata, a map, memories, names, values, all these things we always talk about. The next thing is volition. So now it turns into wanting, wanting to get rid of it, wanting to hold on to it, wanting more of it, wanting to ignore it, wanting to fit it in and move to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Okay, so we have form, perception, cognition, volition, and then consciousness. Consciousness. So this sense of I, this sense of a personal mind. And all of these things are these heaps that together with this attachment process, this mind getting stuck process, this mind abiding in a fixed place process creates the sense of standing apart. Now obviously when we approach this practice, the same mechanism operates for quite a while. And part of what Zazen teaches is a gradual de-addiction from this way of utilizing the mind, this sticky way of utilizing the mind, to enter much more this sense of things flowing. Mind not needing a fixed abode, allowing mind to flow forth from everything. This is why he said, thus, by breathing in, and not identifying with skandhas, and breathing out and not getting hung up on the externals, naming and all the rest of it, all the ways in which we make fixed abodes, but just letting these externals be, letting them flow. Because I'm reading billions and quadrillions of sutras in every moment, because this is the very essence of what the sutras are teaching. So this as a kind of a launching off point for two series of you. One is just a very simple question and answer from a student. I changed the name. So I'll read you the question. So this came to me by email. Paul, when you find a minute, no hurry. Maybe I think too much. I don't seem to grasp the concept of it all inside Mu. The fact that there is no self, there is no I or other, that our true nature is the same for all beings as well as for the universe. In other words, the concept of we are all one and the same, which is a wonderful, wonderful reality, this is in parentheses. And these are very heartfelt questions. And we are also souls, spiritual beings that come here lifetime after lifetime to learn whatever we need to learn for our spiritual development. And knowing I have experienced the fact that with past life regression, this person actually is a very, very sensitive psychic individual. I've learned this from past life regressions. I have retained my identity or individuality as a soul. Also the fact that I can access to some extent the world of spirit, if we want to call it that. When feeling presences, I feel them, of course, as individuals. They are when they had, I feel them now as individuals, they were when they had a physical body. Anyway, trying to put it all together to reach a better understanding. No hurry, I just would like to access this from you. And it's signed Julia. So I answered it this way. Julia, and keep in mind this mind having no fixed abode flows forth. Each body is unique. Each life is unique. Each set of memories, personality, etc., etc., is unique. So Julia is unique. Paul is unique, etc. But we divide everything up in this way for convenience. But that is not what the real you is. A body alone cannot hear. A personality can't taste. A set of memories can't think. What is the deepest, truest you that can do all these things? You have to go to the very center to see this. So I've called this before, this action of Zazen and of our practice, zooming in. When zooming all the way out, dividing lines are all made up in the mind. There is only one seamless fabric of space-time. Beings think they are separate, but there are no actual dividers. Mu is both the whole fabric, when you're zooming out, and the deepest center. Strangely, these are not separate. But don't try to figure this out because you can't. Just do your deep Zazen with attentiveness and the ever more subtle questioning. What is this really? What is its essence, its substance? The answer isn't a concept. It's a direct experience. So Mu is not a puzzle to be figured out. It's more like a tree or a rock. What is its very substance? You can know this because you created it. Mu does not stand outside you. Now, if all that is too dry or too difficult, just watch the breath with intimate closeness. Follow it to the very point where you are almost being breathed. Then just breathe with nothing outside of it. No self and no world. So notice how the mind has this tendency to identify, to make dividing lines, to have a fixed abode. And what I'm trying to do is point out this process of allowing mind having no fixed abode to flow forth. Okay. I'm going to go on to a very, very interesting, very compelling, I think in some ways moving, series of questions and answers. This took place over some time, maybe a week or two, between me and another student. And once again, to hear how heartfelt these questions are. The reason I'm reading it is I feel they're so universal. I can relate more with the students' questions than I even can with my answers. So let me start here. So this question: I cannot seem to key in during my off-cushion life, which is most of the time. I feel like I should be keying in more than that, but I really get washed around in everyday life by content and form. Any tips for how to stay focused? Once again, this mind sticking to things, not flowing forth. So I answered it this way. From the Zen perspective, which is what you are looking for from me, because there are other perspectives. Okay, there are many other ways to deal with this sense of being washed around in everyday life, but I'm answering this now from the perspective of this practice. So from the Zen perspective, quote, just as I am perfect. Therefore, the attempt to improve yourself or get rid of something is already to have gone in the wrong direction. I know this sounds counterintuitive, but it is the most profound truth, the understanding that Zen training is aiming for. In Zazen, we settle the mind and body, focus and develop Jori-ki, this power of concentration that centers in the hara, and develop Jori-ki power with its intrinsically healing effects. We at the same time open a space and awareness that allows everything as it is. This dispassion step is critical. The essence of this is getting it that the forms presenting to our minds, including thinking, are done and dusted by the time we perceive them. Therefore, nothing need be done, and any doing can't change what has already happened. That is this moment right now. Talking now in our Zazen practice. I use the analogy of the sun going out in my real time. In the sun's time, when the karma was sealed, that was 8 minutes and 20 seconds before my awareness of the sun going out. Even though I hate the sun going out, and I will die as a result, it's done and dusted. Everything is like that. From this dispassion place, it's easier to see what is unchanging, unborn, undying, that which shines from each and everything. You can call this am, capital letters with quotes around it. But when you look intently at it, it suddenly becomes obvious that this is also no, K-N-O-W, in capitals with quotes around it. That is, my knowing and the world's being are one substance. At this very time, turn the light of the mind in on itself. Peer into this substance and get very familiar and comfortable with it. Awakening happens when the substance abruptly is seen as identical to all the forms in the world. Quote, mind is none other than mountains and rivers, the great wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. Remember that quote from the Diamond Sutra. Allow mind, having no fixed abode, to flow forth. So this was a saying of Dogen's, mind is none other than mountains and rivers, the great wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. This may happen, this realization may happen with fireworks, or you may just merge into this awareness, no big deal. When you begin to see all the forms, including those that cause so much pain or frustration, as identical to this pure substance, they stop being a problem for you in the old way. This is the essence of Zen practice. I tried to put it all in one little kernel. But there's a follow-up question. I admit I do not get it. I do not see how undertaking Zen training is anything other than a decision to attempt to better oneself somehow. Why else would I ever have approached it unless I felt something was wrong or off within me, about me? why would I continue to pursue it by making time to sit, try to sit with correct posture, seek out help via the mukhan, or try to instill it in everyday life? It seems completely contradictory to then say that I am perfect as I am without Zen training. I am not trying to give you a hard time, but being honest, this makes no sense at all to me. And if I want to get there one day, put that in quotes, I have to strive to do it. This is the same, I think, as the famous koan with Joshua and Nansen, "The ordinary mind is the way." So trying not to be contrary and being completely honest and respectful, I find this standpoint utterly baffling. Wow, what a fantastic question. So this was my answer. Good question. That's an understatement. However, Zen is not about self-improvement, except perhaps for a low-level, what they call Bompu, B-O-M-P-U, Bompu Zen, that utilizes Zazen for physical health and mental well-being. Zazen certainly has these byproducts, but its value is limited when performed with this specific goal, to improve yourself. It ends up being, quote, just one more thing, and folks get bored with this sooner or later and move on to the next shiny object. At least half of the new students to our Noho Sangha follow this pattern, I believe. They come for a short while, and then they go elsewhere. While suffering is a powerful motivation for Zen practice, the practice won't make you better in the ordinary way we think of better. If you persist and do the practice properly, it will make you more authentic to yourself, less concerned with pointless things, and more compassionate and accepting of others. That's good enough, and I think this is indeed better. Leave the happiness thing to other endeavors, including staying healthy, making enough money not to suffer from poverty, working on good friendships, and just having fun when you can. In other words, I don't think Zen practice should be viewed as, quote, a labor-saving device for suburban housewives, as Alan Watts once wryly put it. It's not a substitute for a toaster when you need one. That's why I think staying healthy is important, education is important, working on friendships is important. Zazen isn't a substitute for any of these things. But these things can actually enhance Zen practice by helping to remove physical and mental obstacles to serene sitting. The real reason to do this practice, as I see it, is that you can't do otherwise. That is, you must find out the truth of being, mind, dharma, true nature, etc. You must be your most authentic self, and you must go to the very dead center of yourself. For those who suffer significantly due to the absence of these conditions, Zen practice is the most direct way to go to this rock-bottom place. These conditions aren't improvements in any sense of that word. They are just being what you actually are. Since you already are that, what have you improved? See how I'm using the word improvement here. This is the meaning of, just as I am perfect. Let me give you a concrete example. Let's say I have a painful feeling of anxiety. I do Zazen, focus, and then open up the space for what I am calling anxiety, with quotes around it. I see the state clearly, how it is ever changing, and inevitably so in this moment, which has, quote, already happened. I completely drop time trying to improve it or get rid of it. Rather, I tip it up a bit, and I see that underneath the surface of it, shining from its substance, is the being knowing that doesn't change, isn't born, doesn't die, and is utterly undivided. When you can do this on the fly and in all sorts of circumstances, that's called being enlightened. There's the koan about the student doing Zazen to make himself into a Buddha and the master mockingly pretending to polish a brick to make a mirror. You know that koan about the teacher comes by, sees the student assiduously doing Zazen and asks him, what are you doing? He says, I'm trying to become a Buddha. And then he sits down and gets a rock and he starts rubbing in another rock. And the student says, what are you doing, master? He says, I'm trying to polish this to make a mirror. He says, you can't make a mirror by polishing a rock. He says, well, you can't make a Buddha by doing Zazen. That's the koan. The deep truth here is that Zazen can't make you into a Buddha. In other words, get rid of all the things you think are un-Buddha. The reason is that there's no essential difference between a Buddha and a non-Buddha. The Buddha knows this, but the non-Buddha doesn't. The purpose for Zazen is to be the Buddha, and in parentheses I put undividedly awake one. Undividedly awake one. You already are. Simply sitting squarely in the center of your experience, letting go of thinking, and not sticking your mind in any place of self-identification, is being a Buddha. The role of a teacher is to convince you that this by itself is enough to enter the conditions mentioned above that you must have. Thank you for your excellent and heartfelt questions. But that was not all. So here's a follow-up. Thank you, Paul. Your explanation got at the root of my questions. Indeed, it is a must situation for me and has been for many years. There is a koan, I believe, in the Mumonkan. Why do you ring the ceremonial bells and don robes or something like that? Umon maybe was the originator. Something about the practice, especially for me, concentrated practice. At Sesshin especially. It goes on how much this is a deep thing. It's not superficial. The one issue I have is that I do not feel I am a bona fide practitioner because I have not experienced Kensho. If I try to read koan, or especially commentary in koan, I have no clue as to what is being discussed usually. I always feel like a novice, but perhaps my need for validation is precisely what obscures my understanding. It's another wonderful question. So this is the answer. The issue of Satori. He used the term Satori, which is a Japanese term for enlightenment. The issue of Satori is a delicate one. Yes, there is such a thing, and Satori gains one nothing at all, only subtracts a deeply held conviction based on delusion. It's important for a Zen student to want this thing and make efforts towards getting it. Yet, one needs to start from the conviction that the truth from which Satori stems is already existent in one's full possession and need not be created via practice. What does Satori subtract? The conviction that there is a solid, self-existing world outside of an interior entity with characteristics who perceives it. The person with Satori sees the precise same world as the one without Satori, but doesn't see this world as substantial, but rather, quote, empty. Empty means, quote, of the nature of mind. Remember now, mind having no fixed abode flows forth. Because the world is of the nature of mind, it doesn't need a knower for its presentation. It is self-sufficient, self-emanating. Think of the singularity, the Big Bang, and the spreading out of whatever substance was the soul stuff of the singularity. Remember now, the singularity was a single point that contained the entire universe, all space, all time, etc., etc. So think of this, whatever this soul stuff of the singularity. At what point did this singularity stuff begin needing selves to perceive it? How did a delusory self originate then? As a result of evolution, body-mind complexes whose brains created the delusion of a separate self were best at propagating their genes. That's the best explanation I can come up with. If sheer survival and winning the battle of evolution is one's highest aim, don't get too deeply into Zen practice. But this one should also realize that ultimately everything dies and transforms. This basic realization is at the root of the Four Noble Truths and the desire to practice. The above consideration should lead you to want Satori, but at the same time to feel no sense of lacking that you don't have it. It's a bit like losing a smartphone inside one's own house. You know it's there, but you can't access it in this moment. While searching for it but not yet locating it, you never for a moment feel it isn't there and that you don't possess it. You simply look more and more intensely. The certainty that it's there is, quote, faith. The intensity of looking is, quote, practice. When you find it, there's relief and happiness, but you never for a moment feel that you've gained a smartphone you didn't have before, and there's no pride at having located it. You are the same before and after. Only now you can make a call and send a text and not feel frustrated. Hope this helps. So, we've reached the end of our night, and I think we'll end there now.